Welcome back to Tad Smart Talk with Steve-O. You're listening to News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. Nice theme music, Deb.
Isn't that good? Makes you hungry.
Too bad we're on radio because the visual is a giant cheeseburger right on my monitor. And I'm thinking, God, can we skip right ahead to the cheeseburger?
Yes.
But anyhow, that's our theme music for our guest today. Please join me in welcoming Greg Dugal. He is the CEO of Maine Innkeepers and Maine Restaurant Associations. Welcome, Greg.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here. And I want to talk about the innkeepers and what's going on in the Maine Restaurant Association and all that. But why don't we start with kind of where you grew up and how you ended up in this area of business or food service or hospitality. And then we'll talk about what's going on in those two groups.
Well, I am a Maine born and bred individual, so I've lived here all my life, actually just down the road in Brunswick.
Really? Because a lot of people don't believe that without a DNA test.
Yes, it's true. And I have a grandson who just moved back from Massachusetts. And, of course, he'll always be painted with the brushes of being from away, even though he was only 2 years old when he moved here. But
I know. My son was 6 months old, and still he's not accepted. It's like, oh, where were you? He was born in Atlanta, and we moved here when he was, like, still in diapers. And it's like, oh, that doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's the price you pay, unfortunately, for living in such a beautiful place. But
I guess.
I went on to the University of Maine at Farmington. I was a political science major and worked in the industry pretty much the whole time that I was in college and a little bit beyond that. So I eventually ended up at the Samoset Resort in Rockport, Maine, and stayed there for 16 years. Just was an industry that I really enjoyed. It's a great industry to move ahead in. I was successful in doing that. So it really worked out really well for me. It didn't really fulfill my college education because I didn't go to school for hospitality or hotel administration or any of those sorts of things, but it certainly ended up being a great place to work because most every conference that is a conference in the state of Maine eventually finds itself through that particular facility. And I learned a lot about state government and working with a lot of different types of organizations by being there.
Yeah, it's a beautiful resort. It's iconic, right?
It truly is. I mean, it was at one point one of the most historic hotels.
Like Hotel Washington, Samoset. There's a group where they're classics.
Yeah, they're definitely the classics. And actually, Hiram Ricker, who was a railroad baron, owned many of these. And he owned the Samoset at one point when it was the old hotel. It burned down in 1972, and they built the current structure in 1974. And a lot of it was built from an old grain elevator in the city of Portland. When the insurance companies would no longer insure wooden grain elevators, they tore them down and used them for a variety of purposes. And the Samoset, the beams anyway, were from these grain elevators, as well as the floor. The floor that you see in there, which is pretty iconic, was part of an old grain elevator and was put together by a developer in 1974. It had some a rough go when it started, but over time it certainly picked up.
Wow. Interesting thing you just mentioned. Somewhere in all that, by the way, we have Greg Dugal here. You mentioned that the gentleman was a railroad baron?
Yes.
Deb, you know this because we've known each other since the late 70s, early 80s.
At least.
No, there's a little hyperbole there. But we've known each other for a long time.
Yes.
I have desperately wanted to be a baron.
Have you?
Yes.
Well, that's something new I didn't know about
yes.
you.
Yes. As soon as you said a railroad baron, it just evokes the sense of, like, the old Hearst Castle, the Getty Castle, and then this, who was the baron that did this?
This would be Hiram Ricker.
Hiram
Ricker. Not necessarily a baron in the sense that maybe you're thinking.
I know, I'm thinking, but you're using in kind of the colloquial casual. That's why I'm saying I could be an experiential marketing baron.
I think you could.
I could be a radio baron.
Sure.
And it's one of those things where it's a self-identifier. I've always thought that if you just go, I'm a baron.
Yes.
Who can say no?
Nobody would question
right?
you.
It's almost like an episode of Seinfeld where there was this guy called the Maestro. He used the designation of please refer to me as the Maestro. And I'm like, that's genius. It is personal branding at the best.
I like it.
Would you mind referring to me as a baron?
I would not mind at all.
But okay, we've got to get back to Greg here.
I would argue that you already are an experiential marketing baron. So that's my vote.
If so says Greg Dugal, then it is official. Then let's go forward from this day forward by the virtue of the CEO of the Maine Innkeepers and Maine Restaurant Associations, Greg, in the power vested in Greg, I am a baron. Moving on. Hey, before we digress too much more, I don't know if you know this, Greg. because it's buried deep, deep, deep in the deep background of my career. But I started out in both the innkeeper business, which is half of your job, and the restaurant business.
Wow. I did not know that.
Okay. Deb.
Did not know that.
You didn't know that?
Two things today. Wow.
Sully, did
you
know
that?
Should
have me more often.
Yes.
Sully, you didn't know that either.
I can't say that I did.
Okay. Okay. Aside from Greg, who's held like real jobs in this thing, have you guys ever worked for a restaurant or a hotel or a motel room?
Yes.
Where have you worked?
Quite a few. The most famous probably is the Eastern Slope Inn years ago.
Years ago?
Yeah.
Back in
the head housekeeper.
And when they had rotary phones?
When they had rotary phones.
God, I missed that. So that was it. But yeah, that's fun doing that. How about you, Sully? Any restaurant experience?
You know, I've managed to escape the restaurant industry to this point in my life, but I have worked at a campground before where there's been a lot of cleaning cabins and that sort of thing.
There you go.
That almost counts,
booking.
Right?
It does
sure.
count.
Okay.
Well, all right, so I got one there.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay, here's my experience. A young Steve-O, age 14 or 15, I guess, in Needham, Mass., McDonald's came to town. So this is 19. What are you laughing at? What are you laughing at, Deb?
McDonald's.
See,
the Baron worked at McDonald's.
Here's the thing. And Greg, you're going to need to
Baron
back
me. Ronald?
you're going to have to back me here because you're the professional in this whole group as the CEO of the Restaurant Association here. So this is 1974, something like that. So it opens up and I walked in and said, hi, before that, I had frequented McDonald's before, and I loved the shakes. And this is when their apple pies were deep fried as opposed to baked.
Oh, yes.
Known as the good old days.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So when I was 14 or 15, my folks were like, hey, if you want to buy a new bicycle or a new record player, which kids today wouldn't even know what a record player was, it would be like, you got to earn some money. So I walked in and filled out an application, and I worked there for a year. One of the best from 1974 until today, mm-hmm. one of the best work experiences in my life.
Really?
And you were laughing. You were scoffing.
I was.
And there is no shame in the McDonald's game.
No.
Because back then and now. And the problem is a lot of kids are like, oh, I don't want to be seen working McDonald's. It's kind of rather do be something cool. But McDonald's, for better or worse, we're not going to get into kind of the nutritional makeup because they may not be the healthiest place. But as far as a system, you work 3 hours. You get a small sandwich and a free fry. You work 4 hours. You get a free Big Mac. You were on the fryer later, and there was a timer. You would check in electronically through the cash register. You'd figure out how to tender change. You'd figure out how to submit forms for payroll. If you were on the burger grill, which I elevated myself to, there were timers. And back then, there was like a big ketchup thing with a button and a big mustard thing. And you had to get it right. Seriously, Deb, and you're laughing. But for a young kid learning organizational structure, it was really important. Because other than that, you're a kid, you're mowing grass, you're delivering newspapers, you're babysitting. So everything is very amorphous. You go into a structured environment like McDonald's, and it all kind of made sense. How the cash register worked, how the back worked, how dealing with customers.
It did give you a good picture of how a business is done.
Yeah, and whether or not you don't have to love the food, you don't have to be, you know, into Ronald McDonald, but it's a tight system. Are you going to back me here, Greg?
Well, actually, I was just going to say that maybe I'm a restaurant baron because my start was similar to yours.
Wow.
I actually worked at the McDonald's in Brunswick, Maine, and the one in Farmington, Maine when I went to college. And I share everything that you said as being gospel.
You had to learn different. There was different guides you had to go. There was training materials that you had to go through if you were moving from the cash register to the fryer. And back then, you had to drain the oil and mix it with diatomaceous earth and filter it. There were steps, Deb. And so no scoffing the McDonald's.
No scoffing. No.
Yeah. And today, you know, I have three kids of my own. And I've talked to them about this. And every time I said, hey, you know, get a job. What's wrong with McDonald's? And there's this stigma that I think it isn't deserved, which is it isn't the cool place to work. People want to work at whether it's in food service or other areas. But when you're 14 or 15, it's not so much about the cool. It's getting a foundation of business, having a hierarchy, having a time management system, having responsibility. And, yeah, I'm a fan.
Wasn't that one of the first businesses that gave employees an opportunity to do more than one job?
Yes. They were the kings of cross-training on all of those different positions. However, you had to, again, achieve those positions by going through the processes that Steve described. I think that the one thing that I take from McDonald's that you didn't mention, because you mentioned pretty much everything, was their incredible ability to track waste. If you threw a French fry away, you had to mark it down somewhere, and heaven forbid if you didn't do it,
you'd be
in trouble.
Every cup. The way they kept track of soft drink sales were you have to do an inventory at the beginning of the shift and at the end of the shift. Here's my second experience. Before we get too far, we have Greg Dugal here. He's CEO of Maine Innkeepers and Maine Restaurant Associations. Those are two different associations that do a lot of things jointly, but there's a separate constituencies from people who have hotels, motels, inns, and then people who own restaurants. But here's my second experience. Front desk man at the Holiday Inn on Route 1 in Dedham, Mass.
Mm.
Okay? A slightly older Steve-O.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And so there was an ad in the paper, front desk manager, Holiday Inn. And I grew up in Needham, and Dedham is like 4 miles away. So I went down, and it's right there in the corner of 128. And I walked in, and they're like, do you have any qualifications? And I mentioned McDonald's, of course. And they're like, hey, you're hired. So I worked different shifts. Most hotels run three shifts, 3 8-hour shifts. And so I worked from 3 to 11 at the front desk. And this particular Holiday Inn was in an industrial area outside of Boston. And they got the most interesting, I don't know if I should say weirdest, but none of this applies to the Maine innkeepers, because Maine innkeepers get nothing but wonderful people that check into to Maine inns. But in the case of Holiday Inn in Massachusetts, you see the freakiest people at some hotels. And when you're at the front desk, and this goes back, you know, almost 30 years ago, you have to connect calls, and there were more old guys that were having nieces visit them, and for like the first month or two, I was really surprised that there were so many close family relationships, whereas people travel, all of a sudden, there is just an influx of nieces visiting, and very rarely would there be a nephew. And so it was just a weird dynamic. And then one time at this hotel, there was some sort of biomedical laboratory right around the corner. And for most FDA clinical trials and testing, they have to do testing on people. And so this biotech company would put ads in the paper that said, hey, would you like to make an extra $20? Volunteer. And if what they were what the trial they were doing required them to have on-site, like lab testing, like every hour testing blood levels or blood pressure, they would get a block of 20 rooms and then have doctors go to the rooms and give the people all kinds of psychotropic drugs. I mean, I don't think it was like vitamins. I think it was, and so there would be 20 or 30 people, kind of like zombies, walking around the Holiday Inn. Again, this does not apply to the Maine innkeepers. This is way down in Boston. But between the business guys with the nieces visiting, and there were these zombie people who were drugged up, I wanted to write a book about the weirdness of working in a hotel.
You should.
I should write a book. I think I have the theme.
Absolutely.
I can't even tell you some of the more edgy kind of crazy stories.
This is funny.
If I ever get that HBO show that I'm pushing for, then maybe I can talk about
it. Well, now that you're a baron, maybe you'll get it.
I know, but now because of all kinds of FCC regulations on WLOB 1310 AM, I can't go into it. But when you're in a hotel, it's a funny connection point to a type of humanity. People
Absolutely.
Are traveling. They behave different. There's, you know,
Well, everyone's traveling for a different reason, and that certainly changes the outcome of that. You know, I once was told by a gentleman, though, I went to him. I was actually a maitre d' at the Samoset at one point, and I went up and I said, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, and he took me aside and he said, don't ever say that. It's the Smith party.
Right.
I said, okay, sir. I get that down.
Yeah, so. You never want to. That's a rookie mistake at the Holiday Inn. We learned on day one. because that was obviously a first-class operation as opposed to the salmon steak.
I probably should have said traveling with your niece, sir.
But traveling with your – yeah, you can never go wrong with that, you know. Oh, another niece. Another niece, sir. By the way, we have Greg Dugal here, CEO of Maine Innkeepers, Maine Restaurant Association. So moving along from your experience, so you know, you've worked in hospitality, worked in food service. Talk a little bit about now as an overview, what are the two organizations, the Maine Innkeepers and the Maine Restaurant Associations, and kind of what's their mission and who are their constituents?
Well, they are two separate associations. Our connection is strictly through a collaborative effort to save a little money on space and to actually have me be responsible for both. I have affiliations with both. I was a volunteer with the Maine Restaurant Association. I actually was the volunteer president at one point in time.
But there's a little overlap, right? Because many lodging places have restaurants.
That's
correct. So there's a little bit of natural.
Certainly on the legislative side, there would be things that would be for both. But then I had a couple of things this year. One was the short-term rental bill, which would have nothing to do with restaurants. The other was the CO monitor bill, which would have nothing to do with restaurants. So they do have their own distinctive styles and things that they need and interests. You know, people on the hotel side may not be as interested, even though they have a restaurant, they may not be as interested in the restaurant part as they are in the hotel part. So there is a little bit of a distinction, but I wouldn't argue with you that, you know, there is some stuff that we do for both. The Innkeepers Association is a legislative, they both are legislative advocacy groups. That's the primary focus of both of them. On the innkeeper side, marketing is probably the second biggest thing that we do. We have a website. We do a lodging guide. And on the restaurant side, I would say that education is probably the second biggest thing that we do. We do serve safe training, which is, of course, required of at least one individual in restaurants in Maine. And we also are involved in the ProStart program, which actually teaches secondary students in the career and technical education arena about how to be a culinarian or a chef.
So when people look at the Maine Innkeepers Association, how big of an association is it? And generally, is the membership motel, hotels, special lodges? If you know offhand the number of facilities or the number of employees or what it represents for Maine's economy?
There are 1,400 lodging licenses in Maine. 500 of them are members of ours. It's a interesting industry in the state of Maine. When I go to a national conference of people who do what I do, I'm sort of the anomaly. I'm sort of like Angus King, you know, hanging out in the bar by himself because he was the only independent governor.
Right.
Because most states have mostly branded properties, like usually in the 70-30 sort of range. Here in Maine, it's almost 75-25 independent to branded.
So when you talk about branded, Marriott, Hampton Inn, the big chains.
Yeah, there are no corporate hotels in Maine. There are corporations that own hotels, but there are no Hiltons or any of those in Maine. They are franchises for those particular companies. So
why?
Well, there was one. The Sheraton in South Portland, now it's the DoubleTree, was actually owned by Starwood itself. I just don't think that the size of the state is something.
But there's no regulation or anything. This is something self-prescribed where, you know,
exactly.
Local ownership, local management.
Right.
Or
Boston
groups.
Has corporate hotels based on the sheer size of the, you know, the corporations, the larger ones really want to own a hotel in Boston because maybe it's 1,000 rooms like the Sheraton in downtown Boston.
Right.
But, you know, here in Maine, our largest hotel is now the Westin, which is about 300 rooms. And
the Westin Eastland?
The Westin Eastland, yes.
Can
don't you
do
love
something?
That?
Can you do something about that? Greg Dugal, you are the CEO of Maine Innkeepers. And are they part of the association?
Are they one of the members? Yes, they are.
Okay, so you must have a direct line to the largest lodging facility. But I've never heard anyone say it correctly. It's either the Eastern Western or the Western Eastern, or it's like the Northern South. And it doesn't really roll off the tongue. So I think it probably meets some sort of corporate mission, but relative to a consumer kind of facing thing, it feels a bit awkward.
Right.
Can we fix that, Greg? Do you have the powers as
the
CEO?
The official name of the property is the Western Portland Harborview Hotel. So the Eastland Park is not actually an official part of the name. However,
it's on the building.
The sign is up there. And can you imagine there? I don't know about actual code and changing that sign, but
yeah.
I do know about expense in changing that sign. So my sense is they would never be able to to put up a sign there that says Weston Portland Harbor View. So they're better off with the Eastland Park than nothing at all. That's just a guess.
That's just a guess. Well, we may have to look into that because every time I want to recommend it to somebody, I get so frustrated by trying to pronounce it that I end up saying, go to the Hyatt in the Old Port, you know. So I can't tell you how much business they've lost because they're confusing me. And I'm just saying, maybe you can report that to the association.
I will. I will tell them. But I would like to also mention one more thing as far as the size of property in Maine. That's another thing that's an anomaly. Of those 1,400 licenses, half of them are 15 rooms or less. So that just doesn't happen. Most of a lot of B&Bs, a lot of small inns, especially in the coastal towns. It's just a state of small lodging properties.
Is the Press Hotel part of – are they members?
Yes, they are.
What a property. What
yeah,
a wonder!
Amazing,
oh, it's an amazing property. That for people that may not be familiar, that opened up, I don't know, 4 or 5 months ago, sometime in this last year.
Yeah.
And the former Press Herald building, and a developer who is a neighbor in Yarmouth, Jim Brady, and his group. It's a beautiful facility.
Yeah, he did a great job. Jim Brady used to be with Olympia Hotels, which also has some hotels in Portland, has a tremendous history in the hotel industry, and he really got it right there. I agree with you. It's really true to what that building has housed for 100 years anyway.
Well, yeah, and we were just talking about the branding effort at the Eastern Western and how confusing that is, whereas the Press Hotel, it's built-in branding. It's thematic. It's what the heritage of the building is. And then the decor supports the branding message, which supports the history. And it's done in a contemporary way where it's still a first-class building.
Yeah.
So
no question. I agree with you.
Yeah.
It's
note to the Eastern Western. Take a lesson from Jim Brady. Okay. Moving right along. Hey, Deb, have I ever told you my hotel, aside from my experience at the Holiday Inn?
No.
This last year, our good friend Greg Dugal here is the CEO of Maine Innkeepers, and he bestowed upon me the Baron title.
Yes, indeed.
I am a fairly frequent traveler, sometimes 100 nights a year, something like that. I guess I kind of average. Last week or week before, I was in San Diego, and the day before that, Wichita, Chicago, Denver, getting ready to go to China. I'm going to Singapore, then to Hong Kong, and then Macau. Where nice. I bet you don't even know how to get to Macau, do you?
No, I don't know how to get to Macau.
Yeah, that sounds like a song. How do I get to
country
Macau?
Song.
I want to go to Macau. You know, 9 out of 10 top casinos in the world are in Macau.
That's right.
It's
really
like this weird, epic kind of thing. But yeah, I'm going on economic trade mission.
Nice.
Yeah, it's a 16-hour flight from Boston. There are some direct flights, and I'm on one.
Wow, that's a lot of
but
flying.
But 16 hours, and then with the two flights and the layover, it's 24 hours to get from Boston to where I'm going to Singapore.
Hmm.
And I've got one of those little beds on the plane.
Oh, cool.
Have you ever seen that?
Yes.
Yeah. And it's
very
like,
fun.
Oh, yeah. Are you kidding?
Yep.
It's 16 hours.
Yeah, I know.
You can watch 10 movies. You could, you know, have 8 meals. It's
have
just
great discussions.
Great. Well, if you're in your cubicle, you can't talk to other cubicle people.
Oh,
it's like Alien. You know where you go in your little cube?
I got it now.
And you land and you come out of the water and then, you know, it's 50 years later and you're on another planet.
Yeah, but it's only 24 hours later for you.
Yeah, but the other part of the example kicks in. Anyhow, back to
Where are you staying in Macau? Do you know? Are you staying at a Wynn property or are you staying at...
I know in Hong Kong I'm staying at the Mandarin Oriental, which is this iconic property.
Absolutely.
It is where movies take place and mythology happens, much like the Holiday Inn on Route 1 and Dedham, Mass. Great things happen. And then in Different kind of movie. And this year, I achieved a level of distinction with the Marriott Corporation. Mm-hmm. So the Marriott, their top level is platinum. But you go one beyond that, and you get to platinum elite, right? I became platinum elite 2 years ago. And this year, I went one secret level. It's not publicized. One level above platinum elite. Platinum elite lifetime.
Wow.
So here's what it means, okay? And maybe you can use this somehow in the Maine Innkeeper Association. I can go anywhere in Marriott's system, and they can be booked. It can be New Year's Eve. It can be at the Daytona 500. And all I have to do is call and say, I'd like a room tomorrow night. It's got to be 24 hours in advance. And even if they're booked solid, they have to say, yes, Platinum General, we will kick somebody out. So they will literally go to room 538 and pull some guy named, you know, Bill Wilson out of his room. And wherever I go, there's pageantry. So last week in San Diego at the Marriott Marquis Marina, but when I booked the reservation, the general manager sent me a note and it was like, we heard there was a Platinum Elite General coming. Stuff of mythology. So would it be too showy if there was a little bit of a celebration when you came into the lobby? And I said, oh, come on.
Oh, and no way.
I may be exaggerating a smidge, but there is a celebration when you're a Platinum Elite General.
This is amazing. You're not just a baron, you're also a general.
Yeah. Wow. A Platinum Elite General.
Wow.
And yeah, so there's I've got that going for me, which is nice.
That's nice.
Yeah. So again, back to Greg Dugally, CEO of Maine Innkeepers, Maine Restaurant Association. So there's about 1,400 places that have a license, a lodging license. So if you're going to have a place where you're paying, your people pay to stay, that's a state license program, right?
That's correct.
And about four.
Does not include campgrounds, but there's a separate setting for that.
Campground.
Separate license.
Okay. And so now you're also, since 2014, more recently became the executive director of the Maine Restaurant Association. Talk a little bit about how that association is set up and how many restaurants are in Maine and how many are members.
Well, food licenses are always a challenge because you've got everything from Maine Medical Center to the local food truck. But there were roughly about 4,000 restaurant licenses in the state of Maine. And we, again, have 500 members. Again, the penetration of both associations as it relates to the market that it's in is pretty similar to what you would see or average at the national level with other states and everything. So there are a lot of restaurants in Maine, as you would imagine, because you've seen there's, of course, a lot in Portland, and they continue to grow as the foodiest town in America. You know, we have a great group to represent, honestly.
You hear that a lot about Portland. I think there's some great restaurants there. And we had Sam Hayward here, I think, last year. And he was the executive chef and the owner of a number of great restaurants down.
Primarily 4th Street.
Known as 4th Street, which in the world of foodieism, or if that's a word, is considered just, you know, epic and 4-star, 5-star, 6 spoons, whatever the measurement is. And didn't he just open a seafood restaurant down in the old Porter? Is that open yet?
I don't believe it's open. If it hasn't, it's about to open. It is, I forget the name of it, but it's going to be the second largest restaurant in the city of Portland, except for DeMillo's, obviously, with number of seats. And I think square footage-wise, it might be the largest. So it's pretty impressive. And I go way back with Sam. Sam used to actually – he started the farm-to-table movement, in my opinion, in the state of Maine. He actually owned a restaurant in Brunswick called 22 Lincoln, which I used to take my chefs from the Samoset to, just to get them to see something different and to get some perspective. He then went to the Harrah-Seacott when it opened and worked with Nancy and Chip Gray for a period of time before he went on to open 4th Street with Dana Street, of course, who owns Street & Company. Yeah. So he's a storied individual and a really nice guy.
Wonderful guy. And he's very giving in the community. So there's lots of charity events and he donates his time and he really – the restaurant is very, very involved. And you mentioned the Harrah-Seacott. That's up in Freeport?
Correct.
I think that's where we eat every Christmas.
You think it is?
Yeah. Katie's in charge of everything that we do.
Yeah.
Outside of, you know, I only come to work because I have some sort of self-governance. When I'm in the office, I can, once I leave the office, where we eat, what we do, what goes in the house, what we watch on television, I've got zero control.
Yeah.
So that's sometimes why I work late, just to maintain. But she gets tired wrapping presents. And so whether it's Thanksgiving or Christmas, they do these unbelievable meals where there's, 10 different types of main courses and there's lobster and there's 10 different types of desserts.
Yeah, good stuff.
Like sometimes I just sit there. But they also, that's the Harrah-Seacott Inn, which is on the main drag there.
Yeah.
But on the other side of Freeport, there's the Harrah-Seacott Little Lobster Place, which is right on, which isn't as well known.
On the Harrah-Seacott River.
Right. Yeah. But last night we went there with Cammie and Zach, and they stepped up to the window, and you don't hear this very often, but Zach was ordering for both of them, and he was like, yeah, we'd like 6 hot dogs. And the person was like, excuse me? Who orders 6 hot dogs? My kids ordered 6 hot dogs at the Harrah-Seacott Lobster Place.
Oh, my. Wow.
Oh, it was delicious, though.
Oh, I'm sure it was.
The other thing was they didn't have apple crisp. All they had was blueberry crisp.
Not yet?
No. And they're like, sorry, sir, we only have apple crisp in the fall. And I'm like, my bad.
Come back next month.
My bad. Of course, having apple in August would be considered something bad.
It's like wearing white after Labor Day, right?
Yeah. Well, you don't even want to go there. My fashion sense is not dictated by convention. Okay, by the way, you're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM, WLOBradio.com. We have Greg Dugal here. He is CEO of Maine Innkeepers, Maine Restaurants Association. Okay, so now that we have the count, we have the scope, we have the scale, what do you do for these two associations that are distinct and separate? You're the executive director of both. Talk about whether it's policy or whether it's, do you help with marketing? Do you help with coordinated efforts? Is there a legislative issue? And then that's the softball question. And then after that, I'm going to follow up on the minimum wage issue and the tip, no tip issue, which is a little more of kind of a controversial issue here in Maine. So go with the softball question first. Like, what do you do and what does each association help for the members?
Obviously, we do a fair amount of legislative advocacy. We work with the National Restaurant Association, the American Hotel and Lodging Association, because not all politics is local or statewide. Some of it does occur at that level. This year has been a surprisingly busy year, as the National Labor Relations Board has been very active on several issues.
Just made an order yesterday having to do with independent contractors not being employees, which impacts lots of industries,
including
yours. And ours. I'm right there with you.
And it isn't necessarily just that, because it was an employment agency and a company that was using their employees, which takes it to a little bit of a different level than just the independent contractor. It's the affiliation of the two companies. So that's where it starts. Even though Hilton doesn't employ anyone at the Hilton Garden Inn in Freeport, the people who own the Hilton Garden Inn do, it does sort of lean in that direction that at some point in time, much like they did in Seattle, as you remember, that was part of the minimum wage issue there, where they actually said pretty much that an employee of a franchise is also the employee of the franchisor. So it is an issue that is going to be an interesting one moving forward and will get a lot of play. But we also lately have been very involved at the local level for both associations as well. And I, as you said, we'll talk about the minimum wage issues. But because of inactivity to some degree at the federal level and inactivity to some degree at the state level on a variety of things, it isn't just minimum wage. It's polystyrene bans. It's single-use bags, which I know you've been seeing a lot of that. Ordinances based on short-term rentals like the Airbnb stuff. I mean, nothing's happening. So it's all starting to filter down to the local level, which makes it very difficult for me.
Right.
And it makes it very difficult for people who own businesses that have to adhere to a variety of different rules in a variety of different communities, whatever it may be. Actually, South Portland's looking at a pesticides ban, things that generally happen at a state level so that everyone's sort of on a level playing field and there's one set of rules that you can understand what's going on. If you have five different businesses in those five different communities, and some people do, all of a sudden you have to hire somebody just to keep track of these different rules and the state rules and the federal rules.
The B&B thing is a phenomena that's occurring in
Airbnb.
Airbnb.
Yes.
You know, B&B, like the Little Maine Cottage, has been around forever, but Airbnb. I read somewhere that in Airbnb now has a market capitalization above Marriott, and they don't own anything.
No.
In Uber.
Uber.
Yeah, this is your generation, Sully. You're an Uberite. Do you ever Uber?
I have a couple times, but being in Maine, I don't need a taxi when I have my own car.
Yeah.
Well, there's that. I thought maybe you just want to have a strange person pick you up and go for a ride.
Generally,
that's not something you. I know Deb does. That's why I didn't even ask her. Sometimes Deb's sitting around just feeling a little lonely. You can call a number. You can call a number and just.
You don't even have to call.
It's an app.
You go on the app.
Pick
me up.
I would like somebody talkative, somebody with an interesting background, maybe a background in museums and French lit, to pick me up. But Uber has more market cap than Ford. They don't own anything. Airbnb doesn't own anything. They own platforms and systems. Does the Maine Innkeepers Association have a position on Airbnb? in that do you look at, you don't even know what it is, Deb, but right now I can hear in the background.
I don't know what it is.
It's like where it's the Uber of people staying places, right? People have an individual home. I have a home. And if I want to put it into the Airbnb system, I list it and I say what it is. I say how much I want to rent it out for a night. And so I become my own hospitality inn or hotel. And if somebody wants to stay at, 74 Glen Road, which, by the way, is my neighbor's address, not mine. Anyone listening, anyone wants to bug me at home, go say hi to them. But if I want to become my own motel and we're out of town traveling, and you can do it.
Wow.
Same thing with Uber, where if you own a car and you meet some basic regulatory stuff when it's clean and you're somewhat registered, you can be a taxi cab. And so there's a new economy, kind of
the sharing economy,
whether it's your car or your house. What do you think about? Because that cuts into all the hotels that have to pay for licenses. They have to pay for commercial building standards and fire standards and, the linen and all that other stuff. What does that mean for the industry here in Maine?
Well, and that was a very long and loaded question, so I'll give it my best.
Sure. That's what we specialize in here, Greg. If you haven't, if you haven't picked up, there's a long format that's constant. And, so that's the standard.
Well, Airbnb, in essence, is an issue. The American Hotel and Lodging Association has got a lot of initiatives that they're working on to as it relates to Airbnb. I prefer to look at it as short-term rentals because there are more VRBO listings in Maine than there are Airbnb. And VRBO is vacation rental by owner. It's been active in the state for a long time. So the issue becomes short-term rentals really, in essence, acting as you mentioned, a hotel or an inn where, if somebody's renting by the month or even by the week, quite frankly, that's really not something that we're very concerned about. What it comes down to is when you're starting to do it by the night, all of the things that you described, all of the regulations, the National Life Safety Code, egress, ingress, sprinklers, all that kind of stuff that a hotel or an inn or even a small B&B may have to deal with is not something that a short-term renter has to deal with. So I attempted – there was a bill put in two sessions ago that was really not a good bill, and it really kind of went up in flames. I tried to put something in that I thought was a little more reasonable last year, and it didn't – it suffered pretty much the same fate.
Are we talking about Augusta?
In Augusta. So this has really gone local.
This is also a news flash. Something dysfunctional happened in Augusta? Hold on one second, Greg Dugal. Is that what you're suggesting, that something that may have been practical or something that may have been common sense somehow got derailed in Augusta?
Well, I would look at it that way, and I'm sure the people who derailed it might not think that way because there are so many short-term rentals in the state of Maine. Like I said, there's 1,400 lodging licenses. At best guess, there's tens of thousands of short-term rentals. So these people don't want to have what they're doing changed. Do they want to be able to continue this revenue stream that they didn't even know existed 5 years
ago?
Hold on.
That's another news flash. Some people in Maine don't want to change. So this is like your second news flash in the last 30 seconds. Augusta could be dysfunctional, news flash. People in Maine, a high number, apparently could be tens of thousands, really don't want to change. News flash number two. Hey, I have this phobia about sleeping in other people's houses. Mm. You couldn't pay me $300 a night to go stay in your house wherever you live, or Deb, wherever you live.
I wouldn't.
You
do that.
Couldn't. And Katie, my lovely wife, she thinks it's like this exotic kind of experience. And she traveled to Santa Barbara a few months ago, and she goes, "Oh, I went to this Airbnb and I stayed in somebody's house," and I'm like, "Yuck!"
No.
Well, it tends to be more – it really is more of a millennial. Not that baby boomers are not interested in – as you may have mentioned, I'm not trying to cast aspersions on your wife. But if she is, in fact, a baby boomer, then she would fall into the category of people that care about that. But more it's millennials and Generation Z. They see this as an opportunity to travel at a lot less money. It is usually more, because you don't have to pay for all the things that you said earlier.
Well,
you can generally
charge. Well,
we're boomers.
Sully's, you're a Z or a millennial or something, aren't you?
Something.
But you're in that young kind of hipster group. Would you go Airbnb? Would you sleep in somebody else's house?
I have had an Airbnb experience. Actually, last month, I stayed at someone's cottage in Canada, but it was something that they designed as a rental, and they just utilize Airbnb to
as the platform.
As the platform. So that I'm okay with.
So they didn't have their, like, you know, stuff in the drug cabinet in the bathroom. There wasn't underwear under the bed you found. It wasn't
nothing
anything creepy like that.
Just lots of mosquitoes.
Lots of mosquitoes. They can't control that.
Exactly. But my sister, on the other hand, went to Puerto Rico on a work trip, stayed a couple extra days, and Airbnb'd someone's apartment.
It's fairly typical. And I'll say that short-term rentals have proliferated. I mean, some of the issues that they're having in cities are people are buying buildings and turning them into rentals. Like Rockland, Maine is considering an ordinance currently. And one of the reasons that they're looking at it is so much of the real estate in residential areas has been bought up to be used as vacation rentals that it actually changes the dynamic of the neighborhood. It isn't just about the traveler or about the competitive edge. Mm-hmm. It really is a different kind of approach to having a commercial enterprise in a residential neighborhood.
Yeah, I can't do it. I wish
I can't either.
I just can't. I don't even like people staying in my house.
Yeah, I'm
the
same way.
It's like, hey, well, even like relatives, people will be like, hey, guess what? We're coming to visit. And I'm like, not so much. And I just, you know, they're in the refrigerator, they're eating your food, and then
they're messing up the kitchen.
And it just, I don't know. That's why I love the Marriott experience so well. If I could live in a Marriott, I would.
It would be neat.
You come in, people clean up the room once a day. You can order food in. They can park your car. That, to me, you know, that may be my future retirement plan.
It might be.
Just find a big hotel room somewhere.
It's appropriate for a Baron.
Have you seen the Baron up in room 2204? Yeah. Yes, the Baron. The Baron is looking for ice water in 24. No, that I could just be referred to as the Baron.
Yes.
That's fantastic.
Well, let me say one more thing, too. As far as, like, one part in my bio is I actually was a Chamber of Commerce executive at one point in my life. And chambers have always been notoriously those folks that have promoted these short-term rentals. And when I was at a chamber, we had a piece of paper that we would mail to people. It was a little booklet that was stapled together. That was the extent of the marketing that people with short-term rentals got. Now they have a platform that reaches Singapore, Macau, all those places you were talking about. People are renting these things from all over. So the platform itself is actually an ingenious tool. It's just the way that the people who use it, which are the short-term renters, don't collect taxes and remit them to the state, and don't follow any regulations or rules that they should. So really, that's what the issue is in my mind.
Well, the other issue you just brought up is you suggested I haven't read your bio, and I have. I have your whole. Yeah, you know, you're on Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, my friend, and we have a whole We have a whole. Deb, did you know, since Greg brought it up, that he in 2009 he became a member of the Maine Tourism Association Hall of Fame?
No, I did not.
Did you know there was a Hall of Fame for Maine tourism?
I did not.
You haven't visited, really?
No, I really have not.
What the heck?
No.
Oh, great. Tell her what an exciting experience it is visiting the Maine Tourism Association Hall of Fame. It's almost like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It's a little bit like baseball, or, you know, go to Canton for football. The Maine State Tourism Hall of Fame has that kind of appeal.
Sure, I'm sure it does.
So we'll have to go back to the Airbnb experience. The only way you're going to get to see the Maine, my thing in the Maine Tourism Hall of Fame is by coming to my house and seeing it on the wall, because there are no bricks and mortar associated with this. But you're welcome to come anytime.
Nice.
So it's a virtual thing.
It is indeed.
Well, you are in the Chamber of Commerce. He serves on the Board of Directors Convention Visitors Bureau of Greater Portland. In the last couple of minutes, because we could go on forever, we've got Greg Dugal here. He is CEO of Maine Innkeepers, which is the association that works with Maine innkeepers, motels, hotels, and then also executive director of Maine Restaurant Association. This is going to be another long-winded question with a long-winded answer, but again, that's the format, Greg. I didn't pick it. You know, I am just the host. I show up. Here's the format. Talk a little bit about the economic impact to both hospitality, lodging, and restaurants. Maine has a relatively weak economic engine. We don't have a dominant industry per se. I think hospitality and restaurants and seafood, we came from natural resources with timber and textile. Talk a little bit about how important the restaurant business is to Maine in terms of both jobs and economics.
Well, the industry itself the tourism industry, which is a lot of things. And retail is actually the largest component to the tourism industry, or the portion of retail that's assigned to that. So you're talking about 90, almost 100,000 employees in the tourism industry. I would say just a little bit more than half of that are people that who work in the restaurant and lodging industry, more so, much more so, probably twice as many of those in the restaurant industry. People don't realize that the two industries are $3.3 billion a year industry. Three quarters of that, 2.8, is restaurant. So the lodging piece of it is small, primarily because the season that people come here is small. We achieved $800 million for the first time last year, and we actually went from 7 to 8 in a 3-year span. And it's generally taken years to go from one set of 100 millions to the next. So the industry is growing. Certainly what's happened in Portland. Portland grew by 22% last year in lodging sales. And of course, restaurants weren't too far behind in the 15% range, primarily because there were more people, obviously, that ate in the restaurants than staying in the hotels. So the industry itself is growing markedly. And I think, as you said, it is, you know, regardless of how people perceive the industry, it is one of the largest industries in the state, and certainly deserves at least the credit for being an economic engine.
Final question, kind of combination, regulatory questions, minimum wage. It's a big issue. It's a big federal issue. President Obama has kind of come out and said 10-10 is the number that he's comfortable with, and there's a federal issue for federal companies that do business with the government. They want the wage set at 10-10. There's also here in Portland and in statewide, a lot of communities across the country have tried instilling a minimum wage. What's your feeling and the association's feeling on minimum wage? And then kind of an associated question, what do you feel about tip, no tip, if the minimum wage goes up? Some restaurants say if they're forced to pay a higher minimum wage, then they will integrate the tip into the bill, or they'll have to be no tip. Or how does that work in an industry that's been, you know, this kind of an older industry that people are kind of already set in their ways?
Again, a loaded question, but of course I know now that
that's
what's going to be
that's
coming.
The format,
exactly.
Yep.
Obviously, if something were to happen at the federal level, it would cover everybody. 10-10 to our industry seems to be a little extreme. It's unfortunate that things haven't changed over time, both at the federal level and state level. We're talking 2006, 2007.
It would have been easier to slowly, incrementally incorporate the rate as opposed to right now wake up and go, what an injustice.
Right.
Let's make a big bump.
Right. And in most instances, when you look at the city of Portland, a lot of people are making $10 an hour. The industry is paying, you know, from the quick service restaurants starting at 9 up to as much as, I mean, the sky's the limit. The problem becomes if you raise it to 10, which they're going to do anyway, so that's kind of a moot point here. But if you raise it to 10, you have a lot of people that are making 10 to 12, and what are you going to do with them? So the cost of this isn't specifically to the increase in the minimum wage. It's the ancillary aspects of it.
Right.
And then you go back to the tipped part of it. You know, if you were to either change the tipped wage or eliminate it, or as in the case of the referendum, make it continue to have $3.75 as the tip credit, but that makes the tipped wage $11.25. Each dollar is going to add, it adds tens of thousands of dollars of cost to the bottom line. The restaurant industry is notoriously a small bottom line industry, 3 to 5%. So when you're talking impacts based on raising the minimum wage or raising the tipped wage in combination in a restaurant, we're talking, 30, 40, 60, depending on the size, could be $250,000 in some restaurants in the city of Portland of increased cost over a period of time. And then the question becomes, in an industry where labor and the actual product that is used is about 75 to 80% of the the expenses of the business.
Right.
How do you absorb that? So then it becomes, do you reduce the number of people that you have working? Do you find a different way to do it? Macaroni Grill has gone to counter service. You go to Applebee's now and you see that there's an iPad on the table.
When did Macaroni go to counter service? Is that recently?
Yeah, they just probably about 3 months ago.
Down by the mall?
Yeah. So the whole
I used
whole
to go there because the wait staff would draw little names and backwards and with crayon.
Yeah.
And now you're telling me there's another thing going on at Macaroni Grill.
Yeah, there is. And there will be, I think you're going to see if these things are successful that there's going to be, have to be, I mean, you got to adapt. There's only so much money in any situation. And restaurants, tip tipped employees, there was an attempt at the state level to eliminate the tip credit. This year, we actually defeated that. And we brought people in, restaurateurs who brought their payroll records of people that made between basically the lowest was 18. And there was people that were making $40 to $45 an hour. And so the
whole equivalency when they add tips and they add
and that tipped wage, right? And so the general consensus is if you want to raise the wage, raise it for other people who don't make as much. Don't raise it for those people who make the most money in the restaurant.
Because it could impact the industry, which would be the unintended consequence.
You know, in Seattle, restaurants are closing. And in the city of Portland, they don't want to believe that that could occur.
Right.
But even at the 1068 level, there are restaurants that are closing. And there are people who are talking about maybe making a move to somewhere else in the greater Portland area. So it's I'm not saying that they're doing the wrong thing. I'm just saying that that consequence is a real one.
Final question for Greg Dugal, who's here as CEO of Maine Innkeeper. When you go to a restaurant, kind of a mid to fine dining restaurant, and you get the receipt and you give your credit card and the person comes back, number one, they're always more cheery when they're bringing you the bill. And I don't know why. Early on, it's like, excuse me, can I have another piece of bread? We'll get to you, sir. And then an hour later, hey, here's the bill. How are you guys doing? You guys have a really great night. Here's the bill. I don't know what that phenomenon is. It's a little bit like the uncle-niece thing where it's unexplainable. But when you get the receipt and they list out, here's what 15% of $78 will be, here's 18, here's 20, is it just me or do other people feel a little insulted? Kind of like on one hand, it's like, well, thank you for making the math easy. But the other hand, the tip is supposed to be gratuity, which is supposed to be gratitude. It's not supposed to be a math exercise I need the server helping me with. Is it just Deb? Is it you?
I agree with you there.
Does it feel? I mean, on one hand, I know it's all automated and it's the register just. But on the other hand, it's kind of like.
It's the expectancy of it.
It's the, you
and
know.
And yes, I'm going to give it to you, but let me choose.
Yeah. And if you do have customers that can't do basic math, then that's just the consequence of, you know, humanity, right? I mean, how do you feel about it? This is the biggest issue that I think faces the – I'm kidding, Jim.
Well, and but, I will come to the defense of the servers at this point in time.
Okay.
That is not a decision that can be made by them unless they're writing it in, you know, in their own handwriting. Mm-hmm. So that's a decision that's been made by the owner of the restaurant and has had the point of sale adjusted so that it actually produces those percentages.
Right.
And I understand that I believe it's all in the delivery, and so that's why you get all those smiles at the end when you're dropping it off, and you're hoping that they go for that 20 and not the 10.
I see right through that. I see right through that. If they're not any nicer at the end, but they've been competent, and if they don't have that percent thing, I usually go 25%.
There you go.
I usually reward the behavior that I'm trying to – anyhow. We'd love to have you come back sometime. We've only scratched the surface. This has been great having you. Really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate you having me. Thank you.
That has been Greg Dugal. He is the CEO of Maine Innkeepers, Maine Restaurants Association. You can find them, just do a Google search. Their information is there. They do a lot of legislative, regulatory, and representing the interest of a very important segment of our economy. You've been listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week.